by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a really fine guest with us tonight out of Florida. Name is James Tracy. Welcome to our program, James Tracy.
Hi, George. Great to be here again.
Boy, I tell you what, you're really one of the finest guests that we've had over the years to talk to, because you've got such a broad experience level. Tell our listening audience a little bit about your past experience and career and so forth.
Well, I'm not sure exactly where to begin, but I completed my undergraduate work in radio and television and film studies at San Jose State University in 1996, and then I went on to get a master's in media studies at University of Arizona, and completed that in 1998. And went on to get my doctorates in journalism and mass communication at University of Iowa, and I finished there in 2002. And since then, I've been here at Florida Atlantic University, and where I am presently an associate professor.
Right. You have a memoryholeblog.com, is that right, where a lot of your writings are?
That's right. A lot of the extracurricular work is there at memoryholeblog.com. Media criticism, political criticism, things of the like. And I also presently host an interview program similar to yours at truthfrequencyradio.com. And that is on Wednesday evenings at, I believe, 5 p.m. Central Time.
Okay. Yeah, we have that up on the site this evening. I've just noticed that you've been, how long have you been doing your radio program now?
Well, Truth Frequency just picked it up about a month or so ago, but I have been doing a podcast that I have been featuring on a separate website. It was originally called Checking It Out, checkingitout.com, and I changed the name of the program to Real Politic on Truth Frequency Radio. And so that is on, once again, Wednesday evenings. It's weekly, and what I attempt to do what you do with your program, I believe, as well, is to have a unique guest on each week to talk about compelling issues and things that really aren't on the map of the mainstream media.
Right. You've had a broad experience. You've also written, and they picked you up on globalresearch.ca out of Canada. Is that right? I picked up many of your writings up there also besides on Memory Hole, you know?
Well, globalresearch.ca, I usually share my work with Michelle Jazudowski, of course, who is the professor emeritus of economics at University of Iowa and the principal individual behind Global Research. And in fact, I was up there back in August and we were able to hang out for a couple of days, and I was able to visit the offices there at Global Research. And so that was great after having written for them for a couple of years now. Also, I try to send my work over to other websites such as Activist Post, and they also put up quite a bit of the work.
Yeah, I met Michelle up in 2011. There was a 9/11 Truth conference up there also. Mm-hmm. Now you also teach about what, propaganda and conspiracy type theories and stuff also. Is that true?
Well, primarily it's in journalism and media studies, but yeah, those are kind of the vectors that I look at political communication, public opinion, and I have looked at, I've focused on controversial events. that are deemed to be conspiracies or conspiracy theories by our major media. But if we look closer, if we do our work as investigative writers, as journalists and so forth, we realize that there are real conspiracies that are likely taking place. At the very least, there are cover-ups that are taking place. And yeah.
So that word conspiracy has been a mechanism, what, to discredit people that are describing, say, some of these events in that way? Would that be a fair characterization?
Yeah, well, conspiracies take place on a regular basis. You could argue that they take place every time a board of directors gets together for a given corporation. It might be a benign corporation, or it might be the Monsanto Corporation, and then you've got a real conspiracy taking place.
Right.
Say that with a number of other companies as well, say the likes of TEPCO or what have you. It essentially involves two or more individuals getting together and having a plan that will in some way be detrimental towards the public and keeping that plan private. Now, we know that since 1947, with the establishment of the national security state through the National Security Act in the United States, this is something that has become routine through the various lettered agencies that we pay for with our tax dollars, a majority of the public pay for anyway. We've had conspiracies, a conspiracy activity that has been really routinized since the late 1940s, since specifically 1947, arguably. And we could go back, you know, years before that. But it's really been formalized, I think, in our form of governance, specifically the federal government, since the late 1940s, the establishment of the CIA in particular, and we can look at specific types of conspiracies, perhaps the foremost being JFK. And we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the release of the Warren Commission report, which was released on September 26th, I believe, of 1964, and this was the official cover-up. This was the argument that was put forth by Alan Dulles, who was largely directing the committee, to contend that that Lee Harvey Oswald was the principal culprit and the sole agent in the assassination of our 35th president.
Right. I've been invited by Judith Baker to be the master of ceremonies at her group, Moment of Silence. I don't know if that's going to be the only group up there, but we'll be up there on the 22nd of November, this coming November, for, you know, memorial. And then John Judge passed away a few months ago. He was really a mover shaker within the COPA group, Coalition on Political Assassinations. And he and I had become friends over the years also.
So, oh, really? He passed away in April.
I believe that's right. Yeah. And he was really quite a mover and shaker within that COPA. And I had him on the program one time, Charlotte Littlefield, and I went into the lobby of the Texas School Book Depository one year, and she got us in there for 4 hours. And we went in and set up our equipment and started talking conspiracy theory about the JFK, and they didn't want us there. But they didn't know beforehand that we were, you know, talking about in the JFK in that way, see.
Yeah, there's a conference that's taking place from September 26th through the 28th that is being organized by the Assassination Archive and Resource Center in Bethesda, Maryland.
Judith Baker is part of that up there.
Could very well be. There are a lot of authors that are coming together. I think that there are about close to four dozen authors and authorities that are involved in JFK assassination research, and they're going to be partaking in this event. I say this in part because on my radio show, Andrew Craig, who heads up the Justice Integrity Project, he's the communications director, if you will, kind of the publicity agent for the conference itself, and he's on this month to talk about the conference specifically.
But, oh man, that's a great interview. I'm sure it's going to be.
Yeah, it's he's been on. He was on back in June as well, and he put a book out in 2013 called Presidential Puppetry that got quite a bit of notoriety, at least among those that are researchers into the fact that not only our president, but a lot of other leaders arguably are puppets of those who really do hold the strings behind who we perceive as being in power.
Those that disseminate. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Anyway, it's going to be a it's going to be a really good event. And one of the things I wanted to mention about this as well, this is not intended to be partisan. They're trying to bring together people from a variety of research persuasions, because just like with 9/11 research, not everyone agrees on JFK assassination research, as you well know. Over 2,000 books that have been written on it. But in attempting to do that, they also invited the assistants to Warren Commission members. Now, all the members of the Warren Commission have passed along, but they have assistants who are involved in their in helping with their research, and so all of those individuals declined. They I think approached 5 individuals to participate in the event who were affiliated one way or another with the Warren Commission itself as research assistants, and all of them they all declined to participate.
There was the Texas, at the Texas Book Festival this last October in Austin, there was a man that was on one of those assistants that was talking about the magic bullet theory, you know?
Yeah.
And he still stood up for that, if you can, you know, at that right. book festival. I you know, it's just over, you know, it's unbelievable what people will stand on, isn't it?
It really is, and here we have evidence that is overwhelming and that has been accumulating for 50 years due to the tireless research of very passionate individuals, but also very meticulous and intelligent individuals. And we could say the same thing or a similar thing with regard to 9/11 research. It's only been going on for 13 years, but the Internet has provided for us to be able to make all sorts of films and other types of observations and materials available in order to publicize the fact that the evidence is overwhelming that there is, at the very least, a significant cover-up taking place with the 9/11 Commission, as was the case with the Warren Commission back in 1964.
There were 3 or 4 people, names come to my mind when I'm thinking about the 9/11, and Alex Jones, from a broadcasting viewpoint, has been a point man and done a tremendous job from broadcasting. From a writing viewpoint, David Ray Griffin's written 10 books on this subject. So from an authorship, he's done tremendous. And then from an engineering viewpoint, Richard Gage had raised it to a higher professional level through his architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. See?
Oh, yes, exactly. I think that there are individuals from a variety of of professions, professional endeavors in broadcast, in academe, professional engineers as well. That's certainly the case, and that's one thing that I think is very encouraging. Although, you know, with regard to Alex Jones, he represents alternative media. He obviously is not in the mainstream. And individuals like David Ray Griffin, in professor of theology, and I believe that he is retired. And you know, there's Richard Gage. That might be a little bit separate of a case. But in some ways, sadly, these individuals, these endeavors, are the exception to the rule. And I'm afraid that's why a significant portion of the public still are in the dark concerning the event, or the 9/11 specifically, or they still accept the official version, or they still simply don't know. I can speak specifically with regard to academe, and it's unfortunate that David Ray Griffin has been such a lonely voice. There aren't a great many others who have done research to the extent that he has actually done. You can point to individuals such as Peter Dale Scott, you know, who was a Canadian diplomat, but who has done work that precedes 9/11 in terms of deep events.
Yeah, the deep politics. We've interviewed him, and I've met him personally. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about, he's also an exception to the rule in many respects, because he's in English. He's not even in political science, because if he were writing these fantastic works such on JFK and his work goes back to the 1970s. That's been critical and inquisitive with regard to the JFK assassination and then 9/11. He wouldn't be able to get those things published in the discipline of political science or even history, which is where they belong, simply because it's not as if they're not solidly researched. They're just not acceptable. You know, it's something that one does not bring up in polite conversation or in polite scholarly discourse. And that, you know, that's very unfortunate. So we see in these cases where kind of the exception proves the rule. You bring up Alex Jones, an individual that has been on his show recently as Daryl Hamamoto, who is a Asian and cultural studies scholar at University of California at Davis. Really eloquent and accomplished individual, Rockefeller Foundation grant recipients, Fulbright scholar to Japan. I had the opportunity of touching base with him and striking up a rapport with him via email and also interviewing him on my radio program. And here is someone else who is he proves the exception to the rule. And he's taken a step out of the sort of standardized template for scholarship in his area, and he's forging new paths with this new book called Servitors of Empire. And he's had to suffer a great deal of abuse by his colleagues, in particular in his department, who denied him a merit raise after having a book released that I think is going to be probably a trailblazing work. Most definitely. So, you know, there are a lot of obstacles and constraints to those of us who are in a profession such as academe, and I would say even probably more so the case with like journalism, because journalism, we don't even have you don't even really have those types of safeguards like tenure. You do have that in academe. That really does behoove us of actually taking chances, such as what, for example, Dr. Hamamoto has done. And Peter Dale Scott and David Ray Griffin. We have that type of privilege in terms of being able to seek out, pursue new intellectual paths. And if those things are controversial and they make people feel uncomfortable, well, that proves that we're doing our job.
Well, that tenure does guarantee that a greater truth will be added, does it not?
Well, that's the reason that it was originally established. It was established in the early 20th century to protect academics who might tread down a path that is potentially controversial. And this was something that was initially, there was a particular case that was at Stanford University. And I'm going to blank on the name of the sociologist's name while I'm looking at the book right on my bookshelf, and I can't see the name. But there's a particular sociologist at Stanford University, and he his views in terms of things like immigration and race were not in accord with the widow of Leland Stanford, who oversaw the board of directors of the university. And ultimately, the president of the university was compelled to have this particular academician dismissed from the faculty. And this was one of a number of cases that laid the groundwork for tenure, for having tenure, for allowing people to express views that might, for academics to express views that might be controversial and to pursue research projects that might also be controversial, apart from the whims of the individuals who hold the purse strings for, say, a university, such as Leland Stanford's widow, or for the trustees at Yale or University of California or any other university. I encountered a very similar sort of case at my employer, where my understanding, people have told me that there were particular individuals on the board of trustees who were politically connected, who wanted me disciplined for my remarks on Sandy Hook and Boston. And so this is not anything that's necessarily new. Fortunately, there is tenure that's there that does at the very least provide for due process in terms of any type
well,
of...
Well, I'll say this about you, James, is that you stood your ground, and you expressed in a very moderate way what your stance was. And I think that's what carried you through, I believe. You didn't back off, but you didn't get nasty about it, and you were very moderate in your response, but you were firm with your response and standing your ground.
Well, I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that I did not.
but you rested your case on facts versus all this emotionalism. They were coming at you with a highly emotionally charged view of what they thought happened at those two events, those two tragic events. And you were resting your case and your argument on facts, and they didn't want to hear it. You know?
And I think that sort of emotional tinge that they had in terms of coming after me was largely inspired, motivated by the media coverage of the events themselves.
Yes, they did rile it up, didn't they? Didn't they get the, and it was around gun control. It looked like the motivation of the Sandy Hook in particular was an outcome that would result in a greater gun control or gun restriction laws, see. But it actually backfired the other way, it seemed like. What do you think?
Oh, I think so as well. It was such an event that the idea of the deaths of children is something that there's no greater thing that could be visited upon an individual is the death of a child, especially at the age of 6 or 7 years old. And so, first of all, it was a very emotional event. And so I think that a lot of individuals justifiably wanted to just step away from it. But if we want to call it for what it was something that I still believe it was something that was largely contrived. And there are other individuals and experts such as Wolfgang Halbig who come out now and more or less confirmed that. And the research, the information that's come out since then has pretty much confirmed that this was something that was it appears to have been a staged event. And not only that, but the actions of the individuals, the authorities in the state of Connecticut, tearing the building down, so that there can't actually be an investigation of what took place there from independent sources. You know, we saw a very similar thing take place in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, where that structure was torn down within the course of a couple of months. So there could be no real forensic research conducted by individuals apart from and disinterested from the federal government.
Right.
The name of the sociologist at Stanford University was Edward A. Ross, and who was also a media critic and a journalism critic in his time in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Right. The psychology of the public at large is all important, is it not?
Well, yes, and I think with these deep events now we have there are social psychologists who are employed by the individuals who are involved in terms of orchestrating these events, who are called in to be able to monitor the reaction of the public to such events. And this is much easier to do now than, say, just 12 or 15 years ago because of social media. And so now there are actually research programs that are afoot that are sponsored by, for example, the Department of Naval Intelligence in order to monitor the social media, the types of responses to events such as a Boston bombing or a Sandy Hook in order to be able to gauge and modify these types of events, not to mention other events. Such as things that are taking place overseas. So these are acts of terrorism, regardless of their origin. And, you know, the major...
Does it resemble Gladio type of operations that occurred in Europe decades earlier?
Oh, yeah. I think most definitely. And the argument has been made that this is kind of a Gladio II that is playing out in the United States. You have all of these shootings that take place, many of them taking place within the course of a few days or weeks. It seems very unusual. And for a while over the summer, for example, it seemed as if there are so many taking place, it was difficult to really keep track of them all. But these have sort of there's a certain degree of artifice to all of them. And yet we no longer have a media, and one could argue that we never really did, but today.
Right. That's a good point, James.
As far as the mainstream media goes, we don't have a media that will actually dig in and look at what took place. If you look at what played out in the wake of November 22nd, 1963, the media were more or less there to enforce, to drive home a particular narrative that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin. And we saw the same thing with regard to MLK and James Earl Ray and RFK and Sirhan Sirhan. The media did not revisit those events as they should have and done due diligence and really scrutinized the investigations into those events. And they still haven't done that today. We saw, you know, with the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy in November of 1963, the media were essentially in lockstep in terms of their clinging to and their promotion of the Warren Commission's findings. And up to 70% of the U.S. public no longer believe it. They don't accept it, depending on which poll you look at. So it's something that there is definitely something at play there in terms of strategizing, in terms of getting certain types of agendas through. And we look at how long how far things have progressed since April 19th of 1996, for example, in terms of the whittling away of our civil liberties. And 9/11 took a great big chunk out of those. As was stated following the alleged underwear bomber by Kurt Haskell, who was the attorney involved, he actually witnessed what were likely intelligence agents getting this rather disoriented Abdul Talib on the plane, you know, who would eventually detonate his undergarments.
You know, boy,
he made the most astute observation in that this is something more or less these types of events are done. They are also puffed up by the media in order to get certain policies through. And, you know, we know that Michael Chertoff was involved in the company that was making these scanners, these naked body scanners that were subsequently rolled out and installed in the airports after that event. That was a trigger event. But those things, as you know, George, were on the assembly line. They were manufactured. They were ready to go. There just needed to be the basis for those things to be put out there and put into use, and that was it. And you know that's why if you opt out of those things, which are dangerous to one's health, you have to go through a full body search, which is really rather humiliating. And
right.
You know, the whole thing is all rooted back to the 9/11 event itself.
But you know, you have you have an experience level now, don't you? And you're teaching and your research and you're beginning to bring it together. And I like your approach. You're level-headed, you're moderate, but you rest your case on facts. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what carries the day for you. What comments would you have about that? What I said?
Well, I'd like to think that I do. I think as an academic, and particularly someone that teaches journalism and the like, that you want to be as level-headed as possible. Objectivity is nothing that anyone can achieve, but it's something that you can strive for. You can be fair. You want to be able to listen to all sides. And at the end of the day, You know, the American people have to a large degree been hoodwinked by event after event after event. I think, George, it really comes down to the fact that the American people are too good-hearted. They're too trusting in their leaders. We have, you know.
Yes, absolutely. You're right.
You bring up psychology. I think we have something along the lines of battered spousal syndrome or the equivalent in that we make up excuses for these abuses without realizing that we ourselves, the body politic, have been abused. We are being abused on a systematic basis, on a regular basis. And that's very sad. That's very depressing. If you have loved ones, young ones and so forth that you care about, and that we have this citizenry that is in many ways, not everyone, but a large portion of the population are really out of touch in that regard, with their own situation. And so they make up excuses for, those that govern us. Oh, it can't be that bad. No one would do anything that bad, because they don't come in contact with people at the supermarket checkout or their neighbors or people down at the ice cream social, who are that bad, because the bulk of us are in fact good.
Yeah, Dr. Colin Ross out of Dallas area, he's a world's authority on DID, dissociative identity disorder, and he concurs with me. I made an assertion one night, and he agreed with it. But basically, concerning 9/11, we were talking about that, was that there was a disassociative type of dynamic to some degree induced into the American public, and it was sort of like trauma-based programming, see? And I don't think the American public has overcome that yet or come out of that trauma. See what I mean?
Yeah, and we have all experienced this as a collective, as a... And I think that probably the epitome of that, the greatest example of that, is 9/11 itself. And there are still no solid answers as to how that event took place in terms of bringing it to light in terms of the broader public and so forth. And so the public relies to a certain degree on fantasy. They cling to the official narrative that is presented to them by the paternal or the maternal figure, the parental figure of the government.
It's such a preposterous event that it's hard. It presents a mind boggle to the average individual to try to go to where the facts could lead them. They're not wanting to, because they'd have to admit something about government and the leadership and maybe the evil that persists within some of this leadership. See, and they just don't want to go there. What do you think?
Well, and they don't want to go there because if they're honest with themselves and they actually do begin to do some research and pay attention to the people that have done research and do know what they're talking about, they themselves would have to do something. And at the end of the day, they don't want to. They don't want to give away. They don't want to give up their everyday kinds of conveniences in terms of going to the ball game and this and that. I can't paint with too broad of a brush in that regard, but there is a significant portion of the public that don't really want to go there. And you're right, it's too disturbing. And so they cling to the notion that, well, it can't be all that bad. And, so I think that these types of assumptions and this type of strategy is something that is anticipated and well understood by the perpetrators of such events.
Yes, exactly. The trinium that was present at the site there in New York that day would indicate that there was some kind of a nuclear reaction along a fusion type basis. Niels Harrit out of Copenhagen, a world's renowned chemist, along with Stephen Jones out of Brigham Young, that, you know, came up with some very insightful things about the dust and so forth, the thermite type. Angles, still cannot explain the technology that it took to bring the North and South Tower down, because it was such an extraordinary advanced technology that it took to do that, because those buildings were built very, very strongly built, very, very hard to bring down with normal explosive, technology like implosion type technology. Building 7, the 47-story building, was your normal, building technology, and they could bring that down, and you see that's the classical implosion. But the North and South Tower were extraordinarily strong buildings with a 47-column, rectangular, you could say, box inside. Inside of that was the elevators and stairwells. And it was very difficult to bring those buildings down. And we're still debating whether it was not a hot nuclear type of fusion reaction, but it might have tended towards more of a cold thing, but it was a far advanced technique that had to end up vaporizing some of the inner core of that steel structure.
Yeah, I don't think
it's not easy. It's not easy to get to. Say to get there.
Yeah, but we don't even have to. I don't want to venture into that degree of detail. But suffice it to say, because then this is something that also leads to a great deal of divisiveness in the 9/11 truth community.
Yes, it does. It does.
Just a huge degree, and you could say the same thing or a similar sort of dynamic takes place with the JFK assassination research community or communities as well. But suffice it to say, as far as the broader public is concerned, is that the official version, the officially sanctioned version of events of what took place is not tenable. In other words, a pancake collapse, because if you had a pancake collapse of the three structures, first of all, they would not fall into their footprint. And secondly, there would be a tremendous degree of debris that would still be intact.
Yes.
There's none of that. Everything is vaporized. And
there would have been a much higher stack of debris at a higher, many floors of debris there.
Absolutely. And there was nothing there in that regard. In fact, everything was pulverized. So there were some types of technologies, as you're suggesting, nuclear or something perhaps more elaborate we don't even know about.
Those
structures were, they were expertly demolished at the very least. And that's a very disturbing thing to think about or to consider, even though that's something that is staring us in the face. So again, we assume the persona of the individual who has been abused and by the overseeing government that is supposed to be a loving figure or the equivalent, something that is protective, and we cling to these types of myths, these types of things that they are propagating, that it's Osama bin Laden, and it's the evil external demon, the evil entity that also, of course, fits. It's rather convenient because those in power seek to go into the Middle East. Specifically, we know now that they wanted to go into Iraq, but they ended up, of course, going into Afghanistan. They wanted to go in there as well. So it's a rationale, it's a basis for this type of foreign policy that is very aggressive. And one of the things that's disturbing in the lead up to the 9/11 anniversary of 2014, the 13th anniversary, is that we have this new bogey that is being constructed called ISIS.
Yes. You wrote a piece on that recently. Tell us, expand on that a little bit. Tell us about that.
Well, I just wanted to suggest in the essay itself that this, in many ways, is the new terror brand, and that's part of the title of the essay. The ISIS is America's new terror brand, because Al Qaeda, in many ways, has run its cycle. And it doesn't really scare people to the extent that perhaps a new terror brand can. So you have these very barbaric individuals that have been trained by U.S. intelligence and funded by some Sunni states in order to go in and raise havoc, in which they've done in Syria, and now they're going into Iraq. And it is a rationale. It's the creation of an enemy in order to, you know, it's problem, reaction, solution. It's a dialectic, in the way of providing that enemy in order to enforce the foreign policy that they actually wanted to implement back in 2013 or before, you know, the fake gas attack allegedly carried out by al-Assad against the Syrian people, right? That was disclosed in particular by the alternative media that was revealed, that was laid bare as being fraudulent. And so they're trying to, you know, go around the end here with the creation of this ISIS. That is the way that I see it. That is the way that other foreign policy analysts such as Michelle Shazadovsky point out. You know, this is something that we saw, for example, back in Kosovo when Clinton was in power. You know, they wanted to create the basis, the rationale for the bombing of that region, and they had various factions in there making the claim that they were carrying out atrocities. So the only way that we can actually alleviate this is through bombing. But don't worry, it'll be strategic. It's a strategic sort of clean kind of bombing that we're gonna carry out. Well, nevertheless, you're still bombing those countries. Presently, we're still bombing Iraq, and we're being told that it's to fight the bad guys. And eventually they're going to get around to bombing Syria because that's what they wanted to do to begin with. And that's what, so that's the end game.
L. Paul Bremer went in as sort of the high commissioner in there between the time that we took Baghdad and consolidated and reinstituted the first government, legitimate government, Iraqi government. Yeah. Well, L. Paul Bremer was in there and he totally took down the Iraqi army.
Okay? Yeah. Uh-huh, right.
And when he did that, that was a major flaw in the sense that then there was nothing to create a system of order, you know. They could have taken out the Baathist and sidetracked them into pensions, see what I mean, pension them off, and then reinstituted and called back the army and at least established an army that could establish some order within the state of Iraq, and they never did that, and they had terrorism ever since then, see?
Well, the terrorism as well in Iraq at the time.
Yep.
Provided for a rationale for U.S. forces to remain in there to allegedly maintain order, right?
Yes.
We also know now that there were instances, for example, where there were British soldiers that were actually they were dressed up in Muslim garb and carrying out terrorist acts. You recall this back in 2004. They were apprehended by the Iraqi police, and they were rescued by British forces.
Yes, that's right.
Actually, it was pink. So, you know,
was that in Basra in the southern part, I think? Isn't that right?
Yes, I believe it was. And
yeah.
They've been caught doing this. They've been caught carrying out these false flags in order to justify their presence. So how frequently is it when a car bomb goes off or a truck bomb goes off in Iraq or Syria? To what degree is that attributable to U.S. or Western forces? I would argue that it's probably quite frequent, or the blowing up of a mosque, or you know, these things are intended to create a great deal of tension and yielding to authority among the population and to further U.S. foreign policy. I think to a certain degree as well, you mentioned L. Paul Bremer disbanding the army. It's to create order out of chaos, because if you have a country that is in, you know, complete and utter chaos, you can institute your policies that much more easily. If you're in power there, you can make.
But that, and also the Brzezinski policies, though. See, mm-hmm. what I think here lately is, and when we're talking about the Ukraine and so forth, and Georgia earlier, and then now Crimea and so forth, is that the Brzezinski thing has backfired on these neocons and so forth, because what it's done is pushed him to look to the east, to India and China, and that's why we have BRICS now and things like that, see? And I think that, that Brzezinski's policies, his geopolitical policies, have backfired terribly, in the last 10 years and alienated, Putin especially from a closer relationship with the West.
Yeah, well, nevertheless, regardless of whether or not they are, if they are neocon policies or whether they are more along the lines of Brzezinski's, there's still the overarching agenda of expanding NATO. And Russia, I think Russia and Iran, for example, rightly feel as if they're being surrounded by NATO. This is the case with Ukraine, because Ukraine is a very pivotal country in that region in terms of being a major agricultural country and its strategic position as well. And so it's I find it fascinating how our press in the United States is able to make it appear as if, or try to make it appear as if, Putin is the aggressor.
I mean, what they should have done with the Eastern Bloc countries, I think, was to create a neutral stance with them, but with heavily trade ties to the Western European nations, but not converted them to NATO. Then that could have been a buffer zone between NATO and the Soviet Union, and they wouldn't have been as paranoid as they have become. And rightfully so, because we're aggressively moving around them. But that's all Brzezinski stuff, see?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's something that he laid out in the Grand Chessboard back in
19... In the Grand Chessboard. Yeah. And also, they're pushing for NATO conversion of the Ukraine. That's never going to happen. And Putin is drawing a line there, you know. He said, no, not going to do this. You're not going to tolerate the Ukraine being a NATO member. No, we're not going to do that. But, I mean, these people on our side, it seems like that they're psychopathic, crazy, and insane with this policy. It's going to lead towards World War III. It's dangerous right now.
It's very dangerous, I think. And Putin has shown the utmost restraint in terms of not actually encroaching into the Ukraine militarily, even though there are the arguments by the Ukrainian government and reports that have to be really looked at and scrutinized very closely, that that Russia are arming the rebels, the so-called rebels there, the indigenous forces in the Ukraine, or that Russian forces are in there now training or what have you. He's exercised a great deal of restraint in that regard.
Well, it looks like MH17 was shot out of the air by those fighters up there. And there's a German researcher on the ground that was showing pieces of the fuselage. Now they're coming up with something that high-velocity projectiles took it down or something. I mean, they speak in such propaganda, don't they? Or what? Huh?
Yeah, I think that they count on... in part, people not looking that closely. Their readers, their viewers, really just taking what is accepting the person's remarks who stands behind the podium or is able to read the teleprompter or both at face value and not actually looking and seeing what's taking place there on the ground more concretely.
Right. So America, the public, is still being mesmerized and controlled by this mainline media. Would you agree with that or not?
Well, unfortunately...
To a degree? Unfortunately, they are?
I think that a significant portion of them still are, but you do have an alternative media that are making inroads, and so you also have a portion of the public that are... it might be a minority, but you still have a portion of the public that are amazingly well informed. Then you've got a portion of the public as a result of social media, of the internet and things of the like. They don't use those things like they actually could to be informed about things that do impact or that will impact on their lives. And so they become absorbed in distraction. they might not even be tuned into the likes of a CNN or Fox News to be distracted or to be thoroughly misinformed. They might care more about their basketball game or their football
game. Hey, you hit a good point there. What I see right now, this is September 2014, there's Friday night high school football games in Texas, okay?
Yeah.
They've got the pep squads out there, and the band is marching, and the boys are playing football, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Yeah. Same old, same old. I mean, and that's what people are into. They got the Little League, the baseball. They got the Little League World Series. They got the fall football. They'll get into basketball. They just sort of mesmerized by stuff that's not that important, you know?
I think so. There's always been distraction, and
yes.
I think that there is a place for watching a ball game. We shouldn't
entertainment. Yeah, right.
Everyone kind of needs a release, and if they've been working all week or working two or three jobs all week, whatever, then we shouldn't deprive. One should not be deprived of things like that. Or you know, in some cases, it might be a fun thing to do with the family, but at the same time. You know, this is something that it's a question that I continually arrive back at in our discussions, my discussions with students. And the bottom line is that if I'm working hard all week, should I really have to come home and embark on a full-fledged research project to find out what's going on that's affecting my life? No, I shouldn't. It should be the media, the news media, the journalists that are actually doing that. And if they're not doing that, they shouldn't call themselves journalists, for crying out loud. I think that in part is the problem, is that
you're the journalist, the investigative journalist now. They're not there anymore. They're into sensational journalism.
Yeah, and it might be called something like infotainment or something else.
It's entertaining, sensational, interesting, a little blood and guts.
Yeah.
But it's not hard-hitting investigative journalism. You're doing that. Alex Jones, David Ray Griffin's writing those books, and Richard Gage is out there hitting it at those, architects and engineers. And I'm doing a little bit of it. But we're the ones that are trying to expose this whole, you know, mind-washed, insane mess, I see.
Yeah, it should be called something other than news. At the same time, you know, a lot of alternative news outlets, and including myself and the modest contributions that I make, we do rely on what journalists in fact do. We do rely on what the daily newspapers and things like that report, and we call up their contradictions. There was a story that came out last week. I know that Kurt Nimmo wrote for InfoWars, calling up the particular group that allegedly found the video of the execution of the Sotloff, the journalist.
Yeah, SITE.
SITE, right, which had been around
yeah.
a long time. They've got ties with Israeli intelligence by way of their director, and they purportedly found these videos that are very questionable in terms of bin Laden, you know, depending on which bin Laden it was, which sort of get up the person had on that was on the video. But that article by Nimmo went all over. I mean, that just went super viral. It had like
it did. It went all over, man.
It had like 100.
Since he's here in Austin, I pick it up real quick, see,
when
he puts that stuff up. I'm right on top of that.
I know it had like 100,000 shares on Global Research, so it must have been.
This is an example of, remember Top Secret America, that series, you know?
Yeah,
out of Washington Post, Priest and them. That exemplifies that right there. That's a good example. They've institutionalized all these top secret organizations that are operating, you know, out of their own offices and with access to top secret information. And it's just an industry of lies and stuff and propaganda.
For contracting.
Like to me.
I think
they're contracting. Right. Yeah.
Right.
And they've got they've got tens of, I don't know, thousands of people in the network. They did. On a Top Secret America program, they spelled it all out. I mean, you know, it was terrible what they were describing, what happened, has happened in this country.
Right. All that stuff was subcontracted out under Bush Cheney primarily. And I believe those contracts, most of those contracts are still in place.
And then they'll put it behind the label of top secret, right?
Yeah.
To hide it away because of the National Security Act and all that national security state created in 47. And that's how, you know what the organization that really is managing stuff, it's not the Bilderberg. I was over in Copenhagen then in May. But are you familiar with some of 007 stuff and the James Bond movies and books?
Well, to a certain degree, I understand that a lot of those motifs and the particular the gadgetry and technology that were depicted in those films were they were informed by actual real events and techniques.
There was a group called Spectre, if you'll recall, and this group called Spectre was an international group of criminals, international criminal groups that had connections, intelligence, and everything else. What we have today and what we're up against is something similar to that. That's what I visualize right now. It's grown. It's gotten bigger. They're working together. Even at the level of Putin's, at some level, he's still working with the West because of interest, shared interest. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Some of this is theater. Some of it is real rivalry and confrontation. See what I mean? You got to start separating some of these things, these actions, out in those kinds of categories, and not ignore real life, real time happenings. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think the problem as well is that these agencies, if a lot of this intelligence work has been subcontracted out. These are private companies, and so their records are not under the purview of Congress. And that's not to say that the CIA is necessarily responsive to congressional, House intelligence requests, for example, for what it's been doing and things like that. But at least there's the possibility of that. If you have these intelligence endeavors that are being farmed out to these private agencies, it's very much like Blackwater. They have no pledge to uphold and defend the Constitution or anything. They're mercenaries. And I think it's a very similar sort of thing that we see as you're describing with the intelligence community. So these things are really under deep cover, and there's
that is an excellent point to make. In other words, how do you get to those records then if it's a private company that's doing that? I mean, do you have to bring a lawsuit and then through discovery process try to bring that into the process, the legal process? Would that be it?
That's what you would have to do, but it's proprietary information. It's arguably proprietary information. So, say Blackwater, if they have a particular technique of policing or of confronting, insurgents, and that could arguably be considered proprietary. And it's the same with various intelligence maneuvers. I would certainly imagine that they don't have to reveal that information unless a lawsuit were brought. But what if there's a wrongful death or something of the like, and under very questionable circumstances? Do typical individuals have the wherewithal to actually be able to wage a suit against an entity that they're not even sure has been the cause of the wrongful death or the injury? Most people don't. If you have pretty big pockets, you might be able to do that, but it's just so much in terms of monetary resources is fairly difficult to do. Now, even with the JFK assassination, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of documents that still haven't been released. And these are taxpayer funded and supported agencies, the intelligence agencies. We still haven't they still haven't seen the light of day. So you make the argument that, maybe there isn't that big of a difference. But I would contend that there still, in fact, is. You had a movie in the early 1990s that came out, JFK, that actually did provide the basis for the establishment of the Assassination Records Review Board and the majority of the public, a significant number of the public, to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute. There are records that you got that we want to see. And as a result, a lot of those were released. Not all of them were, but there were a lot that were released. And so we know a lot more over the past 20 years about that event than we likely would have if that film were never made.
Yeah, we're at the end of the program now, but I want to thank you so much. And would you like to conclude with some quick remarks here before we sign off?
Well, I suppose, for example, that we might want to be on our toes and keep track of the news in terms of the approach of the anniversary of 9/11. It's also be interesting to see actually how the event is depicted by the mainstream media. Are there any cracks? Are there any fissures in that edifice of misinformation? That's about all I would suggest right now.